Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, you know the cassette tape, the 8-track tape, digital cassettes, remember those for a short time? FM quad, AM stereo, reel-to-reel. These are all audio standards and transmission standards that have come and gone. But what about multiplex FM? It's still around, almost 60 years old. Richard Burden is one of the guys who tested that standard and made recommendations to the FCC. We're talking to Richard coming up next on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you in part by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By BSW, broadcast supply worldwide. Broadcast gear from people you trust. And by Direct Current, broadcast e-newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. And I'm very excited that we've got this amazing guest with us this week. Chris Tobin is my usual co-host. He'll be here in a few minutes. He's doing some final setup of his set. I don't know what, you know, what has befallen, what difficulties he's come across, but I'm sure he'll tell us how he solved them, because that's one thing we do here. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I know, I keep saying I'm going to get that light bulb at the top of the tower behind me here somewhere. It's sitting over in the corner. I've got a 300-millimeter code beacon in the corner. I got to put some smaller bulbs in it, because right now they just light the whole room. It becomes a red light district in here. Our show, 338th show, this is very exciting. We've got a guy with us as our guest today. His name is Dick Burden, and without a lot of further ado, let's go ahead and bring him in. Richard, welcome to This Week in Radio Tech.
Well, here I am, Kurt. We promised this for a long time now, so now we're going to actually do it.
Well, a lot of our engineering viewers and listeners know exactly who you are, but amazingly, there are some who don't, especially some of the younger whippersnappers may not know exactly who Richard Burden is. So I'm going to mention a couple things from your profile on the AES website. You have... you're an AES Life Fellow. That's a pretty big honor right there. You're an SBE Fellow, and you don't get to be a fellow if you hadn't done some significant stuff. SBE Lifetime Achievement Award, SMPTE, Lifetime Member, participant in standards like the FM Stereo NRSC Standard, the TV Stereo NRSC Standard, and the NRSC standards, I guess for AM. You can tell me about that. And you are the father of what is known as the Traveler's Information Service, or TIS. So we've got a lot to talk about. By the way, welcome in from California. I guess you're out there on the West Coast. What are you in Canoga Park?
Canoga Park it is.
Good deal. And, hey, people are going to ask about the room that you're coming to us from. You've got a lot of gear in there. It looks like an engineer's dream cave. Tell me about where you're at there.
Well, this is my man cave. I'm actually sitting in my laboratory or shop area, whatever you might want to call it. I have an office with a drafting table, don't use the drafting table much anymore, with desk and listening areas and the like in another room to the side of me here. But I spend most of my time here in this particular room. I have my computer here, and this is where I do most of my work.
Well, good deal. I have a workshop too, but it's in pathetic shape compared to yours. I got to spend time with the studio. That's what I end up spending time with. It looks like you still do some real actual engineering. You still drill cabinets and build things, or at least you have the ability to. You got a drill press right there close by.
Oh, yes, I do, and I've built a lot of basic equipment over the years. I've done a lot with the Traveler's Information Service, and actually when I had my company back on the East Coast, we actually built a lot of consoles for radio and for some television.
Really?
Recordings? Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Custom-built
consoles then?
Yes.
You know, I'm a little younger than you. But I've been around this business a long time, too, and I have never, ever experienced a custom-built console. I've heard of them and heard of people who built them. Dr. Barry Blesser for example, who's on the staff at my employer, TELUS Alliance. He built a custom console at MIT. So, wow. Wow. Tell us about your favorite custom console. What was really a good accomplishment for you there?
Well, we had one of the early stereo consoles that was transistorized, built in 73. Mm-hmm. Was the first one. We built about a dozen of them, and everybody caught up with us. But my biggest thrill was the specialized console we built for NBC television.
Oh.
We looked at their design, was not particularly happy with it. We changed it so that basically everything was in one rack cabinet and it was remote controlled from the console. That way we presented a lot of the flow did not go back and forth through transformers. And that did a much better job of getting what we wanted to get done and accomplished. So that was one of my bigger jobs. We built a recording console for Mark Century for their Jingle House. And you call Noah's Ark that was done. That was the first recording done out of that studio. I was there at the time. It was hilarious.
So, wow.
Yeah.
Now,
a lot of those things.
Richard, I became... informed or acquainted with you from your work with the FM stereo standard. And I guess it was 2 or 3 years ago at an AES convention. It must have been in New York where
an assemblage. Yes, it was in New York.
Yeah, okay. An assemblage of engineers was put together? Yeah. And so would you told a lot of that story during that. And I'll tell you what. We're going to tell that story in just a minute, but we do have we got a couple of sponsors, and I need to take care of our sponsors before we get too deep into the show. Richard Burden is with us with Burden Associates, and he has an amazing story to tell you about a standard that has been so long lived, that it's still around 50 plus years later. And we'll tell you about that in just a few minutes. Our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by the folks at Broadcast Supply Worldwide, BSW on the West Coast. They're a few hour plane flight from Richard because the West Coast is a big place. But if I don't know if we have it queued up, but if we do, let's see our message from the folks at BSW. Stick around for this.
Hello, I'm Phil McCavity. Week after week since 1973, it's been BSW's honor selling products to broadcasters worldwide for the best possible prices and the speediest delivery. Now, let us show you how the magic happens.
Welcome to the fictitious BSW Sale Factory. This is where all the products that are put on sale are staged and, once ordered, are placed on high-speed conveyors.
Sound great and save big with the Wheatstone Aurora X1 FM HD Audio Processor. Just $49.99.
No other Sale Factory in the world is as modernly equipped with all the latest technology than that of BSW. Here, a trained computer technician programs the BSW Remulac 4000A computer to make sure the products for sale are available in our warehouse, ensuring same-day shipping.
You'll know when the mic is hot with the Mic Light Indicator. Fits your OC White Pro Booms, only $99 each.
At the BSW Sale Factory, workers are on double speed to route your emails and direct your calls to our happy sales representatives.
Buy two Audio-Technica BPHS-1 broadcast headsets. Get another one free. That's three for the price of two. Call BSW today for this special deal.
Operating a sale factory requires exact timing and product planning to make sure the products you want to buy are priced low and ready for immediate shipment. On behalf of the entire BSW staff, thank you for watching, and don't forget to buy stuff.
Don't you love those ads? Isn't that amazing? The folks at BSW are as creative as they are really persnickety about getting you some low prices. Check them out. Our sponsor, BSW Broadcast Supply Worldwide. And you know their website is just awesome because people literally all over the world, even folks who are out of their purchasing area, go to their website to get reference pricing. To see what, how much does this cost? Thanks, BSW. I'm Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech. We are looking to see if Chris Tobin is going to be able to join us with video or not. And our guest is Richard Burden. And Richard is an engineer extraordinaire. He's been in the radio and recording industries for a long time. And Richard, you're going to tell us the story, because I'm asking you to, about FM stereo. FM stereo. Tell us how the... how the heck did this notion come along, and what was your role in it? And my goodness, it's been around for 50-plus years and works as well as it did back then, maybe a little better. Same standard.
Oh, yeah. I got involved with it long before it was a standard. I work with a fellow by the name of William Halstead. Bill worked with Major Armstrong on the subject of subcarriers. These were FM subcarriers. And Bill was the one that brought SCA to the world. The major had passed on, and Bill was left with this particular chore. Mm-hmm. And he indeed... worked, and in 1955 came and brought this to the FCC and got it to be part of the rules. So from in that area, most of the work that was either background type music, sometimes I'll think of it in a second, we had facsimile. I ran sportscast on it, data. This was the world of SCA. Bill was always interested in stereo, and he, in the late 1950s, had done some work. Oh boy, I shouldn't put my hand up in front of my face here. He came across and set up a stereo broadcast using the left channel on the main channel and the right channel on the subcarrier.
Well, oh, okay. That was the first experiment.
That was what he had done. And we were compatible with AM on one side and FM on the other. And that's what he wanted to do. And Crosby came through with L plus R and L minus R, and that caused some consternation. And people wanted compatibility, and they wanted the same quality on the two channels. And so I figured that was not going to work. And that's where I met Bill. He sought me out, and we were looking into what a possible matrix could be.
Yeah.
And then along came the FM stereo committee and started to look into various systems for FM stereo.
Now, how was this committee organized? Who did that? NAB, FCC? How did that happen?
The IEEE started it.
Oh, really?
And we had meetings at IEEE, okay. And then it got put into an NRS, well, National Stereo Radio Committee, NSRC, at that time. Okay. That was the group. And it was an industry group, just like the NRSC is today. Very similar.
Okay.
And we had a number of different committees on that. We had one to really put down what each proponent was doing, how they planned, how all of it was planned through, is what type of modulation would be used on the subcarrier, and what the I'm having trouble today. how we would mix it for compatibility.
Yeah,
those were the major issues at that time. There were 14 systems that were originally offered. And a fellow by the name of Bill Winkringham from Bell Labs looked at me and said, a lot of these things are similar. You guys ought to work this thing out so we don't test a lot of similar things.
Yeah.
And he got it down to 6. But that committee worked starting in late 58 all through 59, early 1960. And we developed how we were going to test it, the receivers that were going to be used, how they were going to be used, how the testing was going to be, where it was going to be. All of those, which are time-consuming and took almost 2 years to do. But the actual testing was done in late July, early August of 1960. And we had the transmitting site was in Pittsburgh, KDKA.
Mm-hmm.
And the receivers were south of Pittsburgh in a little burg called Uniontown. We had an antenna that we put up in a motel area. Had a motel room with nothing but equipment. As you can see, all the equipment we had. We had a standard receiver, which was a Scott, and everything went through that receiver. We got to a point where we were had to get so many things hooked across the output of that receiver that we were going to run out of gain. So I came up with my cathode follower and enough low impedance oomph to drive all the test equipment. So I was really part of everything that ever went through that little cathode follower circuit.
Now I got to ask, when you gave this talk before, I was under the impression that you were testing only the FM stereo system that we have now, a matrixed system with L plus R in the main channel for mono compatibility and L minus R in the sub channel to be decoded by stereo receivers. Did you test other systems as well, or did you just give a thorough testing of what we have?
No, other systems. Every system that was proposed was tested. There were 3 different matrix systems.
Wow.
CalBest had L plus R at the main carrier and minus R on the subcarrier. It was an FM subcarrier. Halsted had this, what we had proposed, which was to take the left and right signal, put together a L plus R channel, L minus R channel, and then feed it back into the 2 sides, left and right, out of polarity with each other. So you would receive the right with the left down 6 dB on one channel and then vice versa on the other channel.
Mm-hmm.
And this gave you an area of compatibility. It wasn't exactly right on target, but it was like sending sliders off to the one side in a concert hall. And that was compatible with AM, FM stereo, which was prevalent at that time. So that was a concern. We also had the concern that if L plus R happened to be out of polarity, this wouldn't cause as much of an issue. Because with the L plus R out of polarity, why, you'd get the background, the vocalists many times would disappear and all of that type of stuff. We had a lot of that during those periods. But that did not seem to be the big concern in the committee. There we looked at a lot of the math. The 6 systems that were proposed, there was Crosby, which was an FM subcarrier and an FM main carrier.
Mm-hmm.
But they put a lot more signal into the subcarrier so they could get 15 kilohertz response out of it. And in doing that, they had to take a lot of signal out of the main carrier to do that. That was their issue. And they also, with the With that system, you would not be able to have any other subcarriers. The other two FM subcarriers were the Halsted, which gave, which offered the opportunity to have at least two subcarriers. And the same with CalBest, who was an equipment manufacturer.
So the system we have now, which is it based on, the Halsted system or something else?
No, it's based on GE Zenith.
Oh,
and the GE Zenith system used AM subcarriers. And those that know FM and AM, it takes a lot more room to put a FM subcarrier in than it does an AM.
Right.
And
right.
We were limited to 8 kilohertz on our subcarrier. We mixed the highs above 8 kilohertz. We wrote a paper on that and saying that you really couldn't hear the difference. GE wrote a paper saying, "Oh, yes you can," and we did a demonstration in New York with two great big Bozak concert grands showing we flipped in and out and nobody in the room could hear the difference, which upset Murray Crosby quite a bit. But that was our bit. But again, we wanted to be able to fit in two subcarriers and you know, there's only so much room. And that was the compromise we made. CalBest made an equivalent, you know, getting back, you know, to keep the signal within the FCC 200 kilohertz limits.
Yeah.
So, the big advantage to the GE Zenith system was the AM subcarrier took less space, so there was room to put a subcarrier in, so you could have background music and stereo. FM was pretty poor at that time, and that was what they actually went with. The problem with the GE Zenith system was that with the AM subcarrier, it was noisy, so you had to have a lot more signal strength to keep it quiet. And with audio processing and higher power, which we both used, that indeed made those systems usable. And that's why the standard. But they did take a little bit from what we did. One of the issues that we had with Halsted, because Bill came from the idea, I want to use subcarriers for all sorts of things. And in doing so, he wanted to be able to use that channel for either stereo or background music or facsimile or whatever. And then my question to Bill was, how the hell does the receiver know whether you're broadcasting in stereo or you've got facsimile on? And somebody attunes across this thing has got audio on one side and facsimile on the other and sometimes stereo. And he really didn't have an answer for that. He says, well, you got to have an answer for it or we can't go further. And so we decided to come up on a control signal that when we were broadcasting in stereo, that it would switch to stereo. You would switch the receiver to stereo, and it would give an indicator that you were in stereo. And there's where the stereo light came from.
The 19 kilohertz pilot that we know. Was it always 19 kilohertz?
We didn't predict 19. We said it would be between 18 and something, you know. GE says, well, it's 19 and it's ours, and we never got a penny for the idea, but. But we do have the patent on it.
Thinking about your testing of what we still have as the FM stereo system, I'm curious, what about it, if anything, made you feel like, you know what, this is really good. This is the right way to do this, and this is the way we got to go. Therefore, it's our recommendation. But what aspect of it or aspects made you think, yeah, this is the way to do FM stereo?
Well, everybody had a different way to put 2 pounds in a 1 pound bag, and each one had something that they had to give up to do it. There, I have here to one side of me all the test data. It's about 2 inches thick, maybe a little bit bigger. And it was all we tested, every system with a whole series of test signals to determine, you know, what the plus and minus of each one of these systems were and whether they actually worked. And all of that data was given to the FCC. And in this case, the FCC made that decision. It was not an industry decision. When we did the TV stereo, it was an industry decision. Now you're getting industry decisions with a stamp of approval from the FCC, but this one was not.
So it's so interesting to hear you describe these different competing systems. Now, I was in engineering when the AM stereo proponents came along, on the one hand, we consider that to be a fiasco with different industry people promoting different ways. At one point, you know, heck, you could transmit any of them, and there were radios out there that would, you know, demodulate any of them kind of okay, but they each had their challenges, right, with platform shift and all that. I'm not here to talk about all that AM stereo, but I always felt when we were putting AM stereo in, I never felt really confident that this is the way to go. I always felt like this is a solution that really doesn't really have a problem. Other than maybe we'll light a light on this AM stereo and people go, oh, look, lights on, just like FM. I sat in cars with so many people with AM stereo and they never knew they had it and didn't care. But FM stereo seemed like it was a good kick in the pants for FM to get it going.
Well, one of the interesting things when we started looking into all of this was that we were looking into AM stereo, FM stereo, and TV stereo. And that was just too much for this one committee of 25 people tackle. So we went back to the FCC and we said, hey, guys, let us pick one of these and do that and then come back and do the others. And so the FCC picked FM because it was that period of time that they were trying to promote FM. And
right.
This was a good kick in the pants to get it going. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So during the presentation that we saw a few years ago at the AES, where you and other people were there, Bob Orban was there, Frank Foti, and Bob Tarsio, I believe, was there. Quite a few people were in there, and maybe names that you could mention. But one thing that was what was brought up, they showed a video or slideshow of all the different audio standards that had come and gone. And then FM stereo comes along. And, you know, as an engineer, I guess I hadn't appreciated it enough because I thought, well, yeah, I guess this is a standard that has had legs. It has stood around for 50 years now. That's got to make you feel kind of proud that this standard still exists today. It still works. It works pretty well. And it's what everybody uses.
Okay. It really is. It was a good choice. You know, I mean, being another proponent, I still think it's a very good choice. There was there was issues with it. We fixed the issues. It was noise. It's been fixed.
So, was the noise fixed by preemphasis or some other techniques?
Audio processing, number one. We increased the power on all the FMs.
So just bigger field strength for the receivers.
Field strength. Yeah, Danny Van Recklinghausen from Scott said, all we got to do is move 14 miles closer to the transmitter. That was his solution.
Yeah. Wow. What is cool to me is that it's totally mono compatible. Now, you mentioned earlier that there were some recordings back then where the recording engineers were not paying attention or they were looking for a different sound. And so left and right, even on vocals, could be out of phase. Tell me about the material that we had to play back when FM was starting back in the early 1960s. I remember Mom and Dad had so many stereophonic RCA recording, but how many of these were good?
There were a number that were out of polarity. One of the issues we went through was this issue of polarity and out of some of the vocals that might have been enhanced by doing that. And we had a guy from Capitol Records says, well, we've gone through our entire library and there isn't any. Well, I did one of the early FM stations up in Massachusetts, and we had a Sonata Capitol record where 3 out of the 5 cuts, the vocal was out of polarity. So it was prevalent. It was there, but it was from that era. So when you don't have, once you got into the FM stereo area, which was the mid to late 60s, that problem sort of went away.
Of course, these records, now, these were vinyl records, right, being with vocals out of phase. So if you listen to them on a stereo system in your house, you know, a stereo record player, they would sound okay. Maybe even they'd sound enhanced, as they put it. But if you listen to them on a mono record player, they wouldn't sound right. The vocal would be way down.
The vocal would be way down with respect to the rest of the orchestra.
Yeah, yeah. You think that would have tipped them off that, hey, this doesn't work in people's mono record players?
I don't know why that comment was made, but it was obviously not right, not accurate.
Wow. Well, I want to, we have to take a quick break here, and I want to, when we come back, I want to chat a bit more about FM stereo. And, the company I work for, the Telus Alliance, and other audio processing manufacturers are promoting as maybe a little solution here, single sideband FM, where it's not a double sideband suppressed carrier, it's single sideband. And there may be some benefits there. Some people said they found some benefits. So we'll come back and we'll chat about that in just a minute. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 338. I'm Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin is not going to be able to join us after all. He had some trouble getting his video going, but that's okay. I'm here along with Richard Burden of Burden Associates. Dick was one of the people who helped really prove out and made improvements to the FM stereo standard. A couple other big notable things as well we'll be getting to. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at LAVO, LAWO. Now, you know me as a broadcast engineer, an on-air guy, the host of This Week in Radio Tech. What you may not know is that I've had the pleasure, the folks at Telus have sent me around the world to sell broadcast equipment internationally. Now, that job took me everywhere, lots of different continents and countries and cities and lots of radio studios. And I've seen a lot of broadcasting and the different and pretty imaginative ways that people do things in the broadcasting industry. That's one of the reasons I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, LAVO, L-A-W-O. You can see their website at LAVO, L-A-W-O.com. LAVO is famous around the world for television audio and video, especially for high-profile event coverage like the Olympics, World Cup Soccer, the Grammy Awards. When the broadcast is mission critical, you're very likely to find a LAVO console there. You wouldn't believe how the stuff is built. I mean, it's really over-engineered. Lots of redundancy. The backups have backups. There's no do-overs in event broadcasting, and dead air will kill your career. Well, you might be wondering, why should I care? Because I'm not doing television. I'm in radio. Well, radio guys, we hate dead air even more than TV guys do. We got nothing when there's dead air going on, which is why broadcasters like NPR, the CBC, and the BBC, to name a few, by LAVO radio consoles. Now, being this involved in TV and radio around the world means that LAVO is thinking a lot about the future, too. We know that all types of media are converging on a common IP delivery platform. LAVO's ready for that with broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, too, and control of every studio device using just an off-the-shelf computer network. And after that, well, there's virtualization coming along and broadcasting from the cloud. Yeah, you can use other people's computers to do this. LAVO is building those tools right now. So if bulletproof reliability and 5 nines of uptime and being future-proof are important to you, well, please check out LAVO. Now, here's how you check it out. I want you to do this when you go check it out. It gives us a little credit. Go to lavo.com/twirt, lawo.com/twirt to find out more. I'd appreciate if you'd bookmark that. Check it out. You'll see what they've got to offer. And hey, if you're in television, you know, they have some very cool video over IP offerings coming along now. Lavo.com/TWIRT, Twirt. Thanks to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode 338 with Kirk Harnack, and Richard Burden is with us right now. And so we've been talking about the FM stereo standard that's lived for 50-plus years and doing just great. Richard, I felt like I've understood FM stereo and the composite or multiplex signal pretty well. You know what really helped me understand this signal is an article written by a booklet written by Jeffrey Mendenhall when he worked for Broadcast Electronics. Now he then worked for Harris, and I believe he's mostly retired now. He does some consulting work, but man, he wrote a great article about the care and feeding of your composite signal when he worked for Broadcast Electronics, and that really got me to understand what was going on with this composite signal. At least I figured I did. If engineers really want to have a better understanding of composite, and so it's less of a mystery to them, do you have a suggestion as to what they might look at, read, or help them understand this?
Oh, not really. But I went through it. One of the interesting things when we first started to put FM stereo on the air was the transmitters. Some of the transmitters were what we call the old sericoid, where you would start with a crystal around 100 kilohertz and multiply up till you got to your operating frequency.
Oh, my.
RCA basically went in at one frequency, so everything went in the same input. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, working with sericoids was an interesting scene. Getting these two channels where you would add the subcarrier about either 1/6 or 1/8 of operating frequency, and everything, the main channel came up all the way through all these other multiplications. The actual mm-hmm. multiplication in a sericoid is 864 times. So trying to phase, make compensate and amplitude compensate for all these differentials in using a sericoid was interesting. I've done it. It gives you a lot of work and gives you a lot of headache, and you finally get it. But the way to do it is put it all in the same input, and then you can easily tweak the phase and amplitude differences to match. One of the interesting things when we first started to do this, there were no FM stereo monitors. We had mm-hmm. to be able to find a way to do that. And I remember calling the people at the FCC, and I said, what is your standard on being able to measure this? And they said, use the Scott tuner and adapter. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, that's fine, but you're supposed to be measuring roughly 30 dB, and the tuner is only good for 20, so you can't make the measurement. So there was silence, and we came up on a plan to be able to look at the baseband signal and look at peak versus baseline. And mm-hmm. that's how we determine. That's where the 29.7 comes from in the standard. It's 30-1 boxes on an oscilloscope. So you had a peak of the main of, say, the left channel to the right channel. The peak on the one channel would be the 30 boxes, and the other would be as close to zero as you can.
Yeah.
And that was very difficult to do with the sericoids. But as you improved and made better direct FMs, that was obviously the way to go. And after getting involved in these things two or three times, that was my recommendation, is to, you know, move to the direct FM. And that's what you see now is direct FM. Direct FM.
So I'm going to say something that's way above my pay grade, but as I mentioned, my employers, folks at the TELUS Alliance, and I was talking to a guy whose title is our Chief Science Officer. Sounds like a starship, but that's his title. It's Greg Shea at TELUS, and Greg was originally hired by Frank Foti at Omnia to come up with in software, come up with a stereo generator. And Greg was not real familiar with broadcast. He was familiar with audio, so he looked at the problem, looked at the standards, and years later, he was telling me in an interview, Kirk, I designed mathematically basically the perfect stereo generator. It performs as well as the math that we have. And I don't know exactly what all he means by that. I'm sure people who are into math and DSP would understand that pretty well. Mm-hmm. But that leads me to my next question. You know, now that we can generate perfect stereo baseband as good as math will allow, what do you think about this notion of a single sideband? The idea being to get rid of the upper sideband, and you are transmitting slightly less components of the multiplex that will reflect in multipath conditions. So if we could just get it down to a smaller amount of bandwidth, we could have less multipath effects. So that's the notion. Some people say, hey, it's really helped out. Others say, I don't notice any difference. What do you think about this?
Well, when we were looking at that, when we were doing the FM stereo test, I remarked to Harold Cassis, who was from the FCC, saying, why do we have to use both sidebands now? I was not into the thinking of all of that, but I'm saying, there's such a thing as single sideband. It gives you more room for other things. I think some of the problems when you do that is you got to be careful with overshoots and overmodulations, things like that. I think that those things appeared. I never got involved in working with that. These were just it was just a comment at the time I made it. But I think as you they should both work. Whether one is better than the other and to change everything is another matter. I question that. Double sideband seemed to work well and be okay. And you would save, some spectrum space if you were to go to single sideband. The question was, what artifacts is that going to bring in?
And it turned out that the testing that they did at Omnia with the Telus Alliance some years back, they could find only positive benefits, except there were a few really old radios that were not phase lock loop that they said had some difficulty with that. I don't know what the difficulty was. Now that we're doing, in fact, there's a white paper coming up at NAB about this. There are techniques now that because we have such fast computers, we can generate the stereo baseband with a double sideband, L minus R, and then we can regenerate it with a single sideband L minus R, and the software can compare the two and see which is more advantageous at this moment in time and can transmit the one that's more advantageous to give you more audio level with less peak. And because just because of where things fall, they're going to add constructively or perhaps destructively, destructively being a good thing because the peaks are lower, and you can get more audio out of it. So there's actually software in the world operating today that actually does this, which is just amazing. Well, let's try it this way, and this way we'll just transmit whatever best.
Well, one of the things it should give you is less multipath.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Because you've got less energy in there. And so that would be a plus. But I've not been involved in the tests, and I don't know if they found how much of a favor that was.
Well, before we move on to the next subject, I want to thank you for your work in that. I'm sure it was a lot of discovery for you. And you and your cohorts on the committee came out with just a wonderful system, or with your recommendation to the FCC, and I'm glad that was chosen because I can't imagine a system that worked as well as it could in purely analog situations and still holds up. We can generate it digitally and make it just as pristine as it can possibly be, and it's compatible with radios that are 50 years old. It's just amazing.
Yes, wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah. I wish we could develop other things that stayed good for 50 years. So let's turn our attention to this Traveler's Information Service. Billed as being the father of this service, and it's not something that we use very often, but sometimes you drive to the airport or you're driving down an interstate highway and it said, hey, for road information, tune to 1610 or 540 or whatever it may be. Talk to me about TIS and how that came about.
It started Cliff Moore, who was the general manager of LA airports, would look out of his sixth floor window and see nothing but congestion. And he said what would happen at LAX was that if you drop people off at the terminal, then you couldn't get into the parking lot. You have to go around again. And he said, if I could only talk to those people, we could clear out a lot of the congestion. With that, he found Bill Halstead, who was my partner in the FM stereo.
Yeah.
And Bill had put an induction system on the George Washington Bridge to get the for traffic going to the New York World's Fair at one time. Anyway, that's how he found Bill. Bill was aging at that time and asked me if I would undertake the program with him, and I did. I came out to the airport, and Bill decided he would sit back and let me do the job. Anyway, we used an induction cable. We buried it in Century Boulevard coming down into the airport, mm-hmm. and then in the terminal area, we had a different message. And at that time, Federal Highway was very interested in what we were doing. Federal Communications Commission had given us a developmental license to come up with something. And they assigned us 8:30 on the dial. And it worked. Everything worked well, except in 1972 when we were doing this, the car radios were slide rule dial.
Yeah.
And you had to look for it on the dial. And where you're looking for it, if the guy in front stops, you got a fender bender, and we had a couple.
Oh, yeah.
So I called the guy from Federal Highway. I said, you know, I think we got a great thing going for us here, but I think I've created a traffic hazard. And he stopped for a moment. He says, congratulations, you have. And I'm saying, okay, what do I do here? So I figured if you could turn down to one end or the other of the dial without looking, you could make this thing work.
Oh,
so this solved the problem looking down at the dial. And so I went back to the FCC and asked for 540, which was not being used in L.A. And it came back, you can't have it, it's a Mexican clear, and you're within 199 miles of the border. Mm-hmm. So I contemplated for a few days, and I'm saying, well, now what do we do? If I still like the idea of moving to the edges, how many radios can tune below 530 or above 1600? And we went out to Hertz, Avis, National, I think it was at the time, and a whole bunch of used car places, laid down our induction cable, and ran a whole series of tests. And found out a little better than 95% of the car radios at that time were able to tune 530, and mm-hmm. about 92% would tune 1610. So the question is, what was on those channels? Well, 1610 had some stuff on it, but 530 was assigned to airports, and I couldn't find it being used at LAX. Couldn't find it being used over at Burbank Airport, and I'm wondering where it was being used. And so I called the FCC, told them my plight, told them that Federal Highway backed me up, that we've created a traffic hazard while we're trying to fix things. Mm-hmm. And I asked for 530 and said it was not being used in the area. And would they consider letting me have that channel? And about 3 days later, it was 530. And we had that 530 at LA Airport up to about 77, 78. And then they came out with the TIS rules, which were made from this work. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they used 530 and 1610 were the two operating frequencies for those systems.
Right.
And so, but it was kind of interesting that you see the car radios came out with 530 and 1610. And, of course, now we've got the expanded band. There are no commercial radio stations on 1610. And 530 which is on your radio dial, is not in the broadcast band at all. Which is interesting. It's the only channel on the on your radio which is not in the broadcast band. So it started off with that and worked out very well. Most everybody coming into the airport would tune to that thing to see where they could park, whether it was a parking issue, whether we didn't talk about any delays in the planes or anything, but where there was parking, where what terminals the airlines were in, and the like. And we had to write these things up in a manner that people could understand them. And so we had to put signs up. The terminals were located by a number above the building. We had to bring it down where the driver could see it and tell what airlines were in the building. And then we used a different color sign to go to the parking so that you knew the two were related. So all of that stuff is still there. They're not broadcasting anymore, but the signs are still there.
Tell me about some of these are on 530 and 1610. What is the difference in the transmitting apparatus between ones that operate 530 and ones that would operate on 1610?
Well, the first one was induction cable. We had cable buried down the center of the highway and in the terminal area. But now we basically moved to an antenna system, but the problem was getting efficiencies up to the point where they actually worked. There are two companies that make those antennas. There's a company out of Seattle called Morad. They work very well at the high end of the band. The low end of the band, if you're starving for signal, the Valcom is the better choice. It's a little more expensive, but it works. We covered almost the city here with a like 2¾ watts at one time. Plenty of signal. Can hear it all over the city.
Now, my understanding is most radio station programmers are not real impressed with the programming that you hear on TIS. There's no jingles. There's not a morning show. But
no jingles, no music. No music. At one time, when they put in the new rules, they said you can't mention proper names, like a Mobil Oil or Chevron or whatever. And I called my guy at the FCC, and I said, Charlie, I got a problem here. He said, well, what's your problem? I said, I'm at an airport. I'm not allowed to use proper names, so how do I tell people where the airlines are? There was a proper pause, and we're going to have to change that rule.
Yeah. Well, I understand wanting to keep it non-commercial, but, you know, informational, you got, you know, stuff has names.
Well, yeah.
You got to use
them.
They
didn't think about that, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Richard, we've got to take one more quick break, and when we come back, we'll have some final words about your work and what you're interested in and what may be next on your horizon, what's captured your attention. You're listening or watching to This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 338. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Richard Burden. He is just quite a fantastic engineer. He's been around a long time, and if you've heard the show, you know some of the things he's done. We've been talking about FM Stereo Standard, which has been around for over 50 years now, and Travelers Information Service, which Richard was a big part of. We got a couple more, at least one more thing to talk about. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at the Telos Alliance. My boss, well, I'm so glad to be working there. Great place to work, and we'd like to share the information that we come up with every week with you through the Direct Current e-newsletter. Here's a word about that.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Yeah, not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by the time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's Direct Current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get Direct Current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything. Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius, thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in Direct Current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about Direct Current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos, Omnia, Axia, and ZipStream products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
I was just looking at my Direct Current that came in my inbox today, and you know what's in there? Something pretty valuable. If you want to go to NAB, if you're going or you want to go, there is the Telos Alliance guest code for going to NAB. You can get into the whole expo floors, all of them, for free if you'll register online and use the guest code provided by the Telos Alliance. Thanks a lot to Telos for providing the Direct Current e-newsletter. Check it out at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. All right, Richard, let's wrap it up. What would you like to send us home with in terms of something to think about or what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a big fan of radio. It's always been there for us. When I lived back in the New York area and we had that Northeast power blackout, It was radio that kept us calm. We knew what was going on. I don't think the internet can do that for us today because we probably won't have connection to it if we lose power. So the one thing about AM, FM, it's one transmitter to many receivers. So I've always been supportive of broadcast. I've lived through it ever since I was a kid. I've loved radio. So from that standpoint, that's my plus. I'm interested now, as we see more and more automation in broadcast facilities, as when programs come into the facility, that they all come in at approximately the same level. You don't want one to be hot and another one to be down in levels and stuff like that. I remember when I first got started in broadcasting, we had the Fibber McGee and Molly's and those type of shows that would come down in an evening, and everything came from NBC all at the same level. It wasn't different. It wasn't processed or the like. We need to get back to that kind of a standard. AES is looking into that. John Keane is a big factor in looking at those things. I think we need metering that tries to keep that on a distribution level so that you have consistent levels within the facility. When it comes to actual broadcast, if you want to use processing, well, I think it's probably in order there if that's what you want to do and the amount of processing that you want. But within the studio facility, I like to see consistent levels. I've wired broadcast facilities and found all sorts of inconsistent levels from various consoles and the like. And once you get them all squared away, the guy says, "Whoa, what did you do? Everything sounds so much better." Well, I didn't do anything but change the wiring and change the levels. That's all.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Good advice. And as engineers, we need to make it easy for the people who are working the equipment to come up with the right level. And I'll share this and then we'll sign off on that same note. I was always proud of facilities that I built, even in the analog days, that, you know, we worked to a standard. Typically it was +4 and the meters were calibrated and, you know, record players would come in at the right level. You didn't have to jack your knob, you know, your fader way up or way down. Stuff generally was at the right level. And if you had a source that was variable in what it might be, like, oh, a telephone hybrid, because you never knew how loud the caller was going to talk or how good their phone was, you'd put that was a good place to put an audio processor, a simple one that would kind of hold the level about about the same place. And what I found out was, okay, it was a little bit of a challenge to keep it all right. And I would go into so many stations that it was just all horribly wrong. One of the big problems was, you know, the convenient trim pots available on older analog audio consoles. People would just jack those all over the place. And, of course, they'd be wrong. When we got into the digital era, and I personally kind of skipped the AES digital era because I worked at small facilities that we didn't have the money for AES digital, and it didn't save that much wire. We kind of jumped from analog into the IP audio world. And, of course, my experience came from the Axia brand and Livewire. But what I found was every input to the system had metering on it, and every output had metering. And it was so easy to get the input levels right, and then they would be perfect throughout the system. And so I'm actually optimistic. I know there's different metering standards, different ballistics and stuff like that, which can make it challenging. But I'm actually optimistic in that I think it's easier now for operators to get the level right because it was easier for the engineer to make the level right coming in. And so I'm actually feeling kind of good about where things are headed. And then you mentioned John Keane. We need to have him on our show. He'd be great to talk about this, this subject. I'd love to have him on. So I'm glad you brought that up. That's a very good point to make about levels. And so the last thing you want is for your listeners to have to jack around with the levels like you so often do on YouTube or other over-the-top television services. We're all the time cranking the level up and down at home watching TV. So glad you brought that up. Richard, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it very much, Kurt.
And I enjoyed very having much. You on very much. And sorry that Chris Tobin couldn't be with us. We'll probably talk about next week what his problem was. Because, he wrote me an email during the show, told me what went wrong. It's just so typical. And it's not Chris. We'll hit it next week. I want to thank our sponsors for the show. BSW, Broadcast Supply Worldwide. Also, Lavo, when you go there, lavo.com/twirt. That's LAWO.com/TWIRT. And if you want to stay informed, check out the TELUS Alliance e-newsletter called Direct Current at TELUSalliance.com/Direct Current. Thanks a lot to Suncast for switching and producing today's show. And, of course, to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. And thanks again, Richard Burden. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.